Welcome to Making a Band 101, my comprehensive guide to getting your musical project from your head and your plans to on the stage and in your community. This podcast is designed for individuals and groups that are either new to musical performance or re-energizing their project. All 7 episodes are chock full of industry tips, tricks, and secrets, and will give you the knowledge and the confidence to create success in a robust musical portfolio. I'm Drew Jones, and I can't wait to get you in my head and give you all the essential knowledge I've obtained in a 20-plus year music career with thousands of onstage hours and a performance portfolio. Without further ado, let's get into it. Up here in Canada, we celebrate a little tradition before Christmas called Tibbs Eve. It was originated on the East Coast because from Christmas Eve and onwards, you spend time with your family. So the day before Christmas Eve was a time that you celebrate with your friends. And so it's called Tibbs Eve. It's basically Christmas Eve Eve. It's on December 23rd. And it's kind of like these kitchen party type, you know, social events that happen. And it's wildly popular out on the East Coast, and all the East Coast and Irish bars across the country sort of celebrate it, and they usually pair it up with live music and a really good time. So it's essentially like a go to a bar, celebrate Tibbs Eve on December 23rd, get drunk with your friends and have a blast. And so this, about 6 years ago, my band was booked as a 3-piece to play at one of the local pubs that had like a great reputation. They didn't regularly do music, but it was a great spot for wings and just super popular all the time. So, you know, it's one of these East Coast bars, right? It's got the amazing photos everywhere, sweet decor, just such a good vibe in there. And we connect with the owner, and we bring in our 3-piece. It was just going to be like our drummer on a snare, our fiddle player, myself on acoustic guitar, and we're going to set up in the corner of the one room. You know, it's one of these multi-layered little pubs, right? Total Irish-y type situation, Irish pub situation. Really charming. We're going to set up in the corner, bring in a speaker, and just kind of in our soundboard and just start ripping. Turned out our fiddle player wasn't available that day because obviously it's 2 days before Christmas and people got crap to do with the fam already. So our other guitar player came in, and we get in that corner of the room and we just rock out all night long. I remember they didn't pay us really well. It was like maybe $100 per person, but you know, the drinks were flowing. We had an open tab, and we played for 3 or 4 hours, and the crowd was so rad. Like we just had a blast. So the amount of pay and everything else didn't really matter. It was seriously such a good time. And I remember leading up to the gig, a few of our buddies found out that we were playing just because we were chatting and whatnot. And multiple people came to me and they're like, hey, careful with the owner. He tries to get out of paying bands all the time. He's got like a bad reputation for ripping people off. I probably heard that like literally 4 times from just randoms while we were sort of leading up to the gig throughout the week. And anywho, so we rock out. It was sweet. The crowd absolutely loved us. There was like literally 50 shots lined up on the bar for us. But by the time the night was over, and obviously we're not going to drink them, but that kind of spoke to how much fun we had with everyone and how rad the music was. And so it's, you know, we're getting close to midnight, and I'm going to the owner, and you know, it's best practice that he's gonna have a check for us or some cash for us by the time we went on, or time to go home. And so I go to meet with him, and I'm like, hey man, this was such a great night. Thanks so much for a good time and letting us play Tibbs Eve here. Yeah, we're ready to settle up and kind of and move on for the night. And he looks at me and he's like, you know, Drew, you told me there was gonna be a fiddle player, and you just didn't have a fiddle player tonight. And you know, at this point, I know fiddle is like a key instrument in East Coast or Irish music. And so there was maybe a disparity in the sound, although our electric guitar player that we brought in is just slays and the crowd was loving it. And I said, yeah, you know, man, it was too bad he had a family engagement. And, you know, we're right before Christmas, man, I'm sorry. But, you know, we still did a great job. We played all the East Coast Irish songs that we know. The crowd was loving it. You know, and I just, you know, simply reiterated the fact that we did a great job and played for as long as we did. And he couldn't let the fiddle thing go. And I knew this was his angle. I knew he was trying to get out of the money. And he's like, you know, Drew, the fiddle was so crucial. I was really disappointed. And again, for like a second time, like, listen, man, you know, but we still played. The crowd loved it. You know, the guest check average is probably through the roof. Like we had such a good time. And I remember we were standing on this little entryway. Again, multi-layered venue bar here, really charming. Like the office was like up this random staircase off the side of the one floor of the barn, and we're kind of standing on that staircase overlooking the room. And he was really reluctant to go into the office and cut a check or whatever, right? So he looks at me again. He's like, Drew, no fiddle player. And I was honestly dumbfounded. I didn't really know what to say to get our money from this guy, and I just looked at him. I said, you know, man, yeah, we still did a great job. Are we going to settle up now or settle up later? And he stops and he kind of looks at me and he kind of chuckled a little bit because I think he realized I got him with that line. And he's like, ah, let's settle up now. So he goes up and write a check. And again, the money, it was barely any money. Like, I think two people at that bar at our party, you know, the people drinking with us would have racked up the same amount of money. So the lesson to learn at the very front end of this episode is to always be prepared, always to be ready for any situation. And that line, are we going to settle up now or settle up later? It was this arm wrestling match that I'm in with this owner. Like, I got him with it. I could see it in his eyes. The little chuckle he did, it was sort of like, okay, buddy, you got me. And obviously we had agreed to the terms of us playing for about 3 hours that night and to do a mix of Irish and East Coast music. And the instrument lineup actually wasn't really on those terms. We just said, we let him know out of sharing information that what our lineup would probably be, and it wouldn't have made a difference whether he booked another band or not. The fiddle wasn't necessarily at all in the conversation except for when we mentioned who's coming in and the style of music. And the staff and I believe his wife was there as well. Everyone was loving everything we did, and so it was simply one of these moments when you gotta have to sort of be prepared for, you know, what's to come in an evening. And so that's essentially what this episode is all about. It's how are we self-sufficient? How are we prepared to deal with the different nuances of our logistics and of our planning and of our coordinating and everything that that might come our way in an evening? And, you know, aside from having the right music, having the right look, making the right steps in the way that we present ourselves to the community, how we're fostering our draw and our growth as a band. Aside from all of those, I actually think this, what I'm going to bring up in this episode, is what separates the men from the boys. The contents of this episode is usually what comes with a band with a lot of longevity, a lot of time in the scene, or, you know, a member of the community who's been gigging a lot, you know, some guy who just subs in a lot with different bands. He's going to know these ins and outs, be prepared for, you know, all these different situations, because a lot of this just comes with time spent and dealing with a lot of bull crap and kind of figuring out how to get through it. So I really hope that you take this to heart. I believe this is maybe the most important episode in the podcast series, even though it's a little more on the dry side. So right off the top, the two kind of important values that we need to really digest and let become a part of our workflow and our performance flow is basically being self-sufficient as possible. So that's like a value or a goal that we should hold for ourselves individually within a band and for the band itself. Be as self-sufficient as possible, and I'll explain a little bit more about that in a minute. And then the other value is creating equality. So there's going to be a lot of logistics around certain nights, depending on, you know, if it's a multi-band bill, depending if there's a backline, depending on, you know, time to set up or sound check and all the rest of it. So, you know, I've playing thousands of shows, It's not uncommon that you're really kind of needing to coordinate a little bit beforehand. You know, the group message is multiple people asking multiple questions before you show up at a gig, even if you've played that gig or that room before, and it's a reoccurring situation, right? And so it's easy to kind of get frustrated. It's easy to have to reiterate all these nuances or details. The person who's involved in the bookings, for example, who's reading the emails, if they're not forwarding to the band, they're sort of, you know, copying, pasting a screenshot or whatever, or just retyping what was said through the email just to make sure everyone's on time and everything goes down. So realistically, there's a lot of work around that, and then loading in gear, unloading gear, all the same thing, right? You guys know what I'm talking about. But realistically, the value around that should be to create equality and to create synergy off the stage. You've heard me say that in other episodes, and that's super crucial for onstage synergy. You know, honestly, it's, you know, we don't want to be annoyed with each other. We don't want to be sort of petty. We don't want to be picking little fights. We don't have all these little stress points. And I would argue most of those stress points are going to land on the person doing the coordinating. So that one individual who may or may not be the front man, maybe it's whoever it is in the band, maybe it's a manager or whatever, that person can kind of influence the mood leading up to the moment. But yeah, we want to keep things as synergy and as equal as possible leading up to the stage, and making sure that we're all really feeling a sense of togetherness, so that we can vibe. So when it comes to like hard practicals, if we're being as self-sufficient as possible, let's start with the stage. Most bands will, you know, have as much on-stage gear as necessary to ensure that the sound that you're curating in your rehearsals can translate or sort of be brought to any new environment and sound exactly the way you want it to. So the most obvious example of this would be a guitar player having a pedal board, right? It's like, you know, we're not reliant on a venue to have, you know, 60 different pedals so that we can assemble a pedal board in the moment, right? Like, how silly does that sound? I hope your venue has 100 different pedals so my five are there and I can build my pedal board, right? So that sounds just idiotic. So why would any other instrument or any other logistic, let's say with a microphone and a mic stand, be any different? Seriously. So one of the rules for most bands, this is like an old school industry rule that I love, and it was a prerequisite that we had for our band from the very beginning, which is you want to be a singer, you have to own a microphone, the cables, and a mic stand. I don't care if 100% of the venues you play in have microphones, cables, and mic stands. Most would. Actually, a lot of venues even have a full backline. But to be called a quote-unquote singer, you have to own the gear, right? It's just like a trade. You want to be building a house, you want to be this type of operations, you have to own the equipment, right? You're not a forklift operator without a forklift. Capiche? So, right? So whatever happens in your band, if you want to fill, you know, a role, you have to own the gear, period. And you want to be as self-sufficient on the stage as possible so that your sound translates. Okay, another great example is your vocalist has a really cool vocal pedal and, you know, they need extra DIs for that, or they need an extra connection for that, some sort of unique cable. Again, you're not relying on the venue for that. You're bringing all that with you. It's a shame when you forget something at home and you need to sort of, you know, miss the mark on your design or your sound and the things that you wanted to have. That is a shame. It's like, damn it, I forgot it. But it'd be even worse or weirder if you're reliant on the venue for a unique pedal, again, or like a DI or these types of things. And every once in a while, you walk into a situation where the room is pretty bare, right? It's going to have a stage, it's going to have a sound system, but they might not have all the gear you need because it's just sort of like the joint around the corner owned by mom and pop. And they're usually working with one or two house bands. And all of a sudden, you know, you talk to them about getting in there and you arrive on the scene and there's like literally nothing there. And it's like, shoot, boys, we don't have any of this gear, right? So that's a hand slap on you. Shame on you. You need to have whatever gear you need to curate your sound needs to come in with you, right? We're as self-sufficient as possible. The burden's on you. And the best part about this is that your sound will always be consistent. Believe it or not, you're not babies. You don't want to be reliant on the venue ever, period, right? Like you want to have your sound. You want to bring your experience to that room. You want to own it. And you want to be able to plug in and have basically all the sound that you've designed coming through those mains as closely as possible. When you work with the best bands, their on-stage EQ isn't designed with that sound guy there. You know, you're going to play festivals or bigger venues where the sound guys are super talented and they'll get the reverb just right. Or they'll sort of tweak the highs and lows, or right, they'll just EQ it perfectly. So, but, you know, we're not reliant on, you know, A++ sound guys at the best venue in the city because we're not working with them all the time. And, you know, that's just maybe not what the deal is. But you can arrive at A++ sound in your rehearsal, and you can arrive with A++ gear over the longevity of your band and your stake in your musical community. And you can make sure that when you and your boys roll up to a gig that what you control on stage is A++. Every time. And that feels great. That feels so, so, so good to know that you don't have to ask 100 questions in an email beforehand to make sure that they are spoon feeding you your success, right? That's not up to the venue. That's completely up to you. And, you know, forgive me for sounding a little bit preachy in this episode, but this is this again, this is what separates the men from the boys. And too many people get frustrated in the scene. They get too frustrated after playing multiple venues when they go in unprepared. And it's just, that's just not professional. And so let's talk about what's in your gear bag then. And let's talk about what is required for you and how to make sure that your onstage experience is as successful as possible. So I'm going to just let you know exactly what's going on in my gear bag, as I'm the lead vocalist and I play an acoustic guitar most of the time when we're gigging. So I have this really sweet custom made sort of pullover one strap bag. It's made by a local guy out of bison leather. I just have to tell you that it's such a freaking sweet bag. My family bought it for me for my birthday years and years and years ago. It's like the quintessential perfect gigging bag. And that thing, along with my guitar and maybe a stand or two, is really all I'm walking into a venue with. I'm fully self-sufficient. So what's in that bag exactly? I've got three microphones in there. Two because they just have never left the bag, and you never know when you're going to need another microphone or two. I have enough cables for my acoustic, which would run out of a DI, and my microphone. So I've got two XLRs, and I keep a third one in there as like a spare, because you know, so many shows are, we just need an extra XLR, whether we're running our own sound or not. Crap happens, or you know, somebody's XLR kind of cuts out, or you're troubleshooting something and you just need it. So rule of thumb for me is always keep one extra XLR than what you need. Currently, I only have 1/4 inch in my bag. I should probably have a second one in there, but I know Mike and Ethan both have 2 or 3 on them at any given time. I have 2 sets of strings. I have our in-ear setup in there with my, not only do I have regular earplugs, my musician's earplugs, but I also have my in-ear headphones. Many guys in our band have an extra set of in-ear headphones because those things are super prone to breaking. I don't know why. Even the expensive ones just seem to break all the time. So we run with that. I've got a DI, my tuner, all the cables needed, including an extra power cable because those seem to crap out frequently as well. Extra sets of batteries for everything. And I have a shaker because you never know when that drunk old lady comes up to the show and she's like, I want to play in the band. You're like, here's a shaker, lady. And she just rocks out beside the stage all night long. That happens all the time. But yeah, no, that's just, that's funny. I just had to bring that up. But, you know, so it's essentially everything I need, and I'm self-sufficient there. And of course, I have my mic stand as needed. It's always sitting in the car. I bring, every once in a while, I'm reading chord sheets and or looking at a new song that we've written in my little binder. So I also bring a little music stand as well. This sounds like a decent amount of gear, but my bag isn't huge. It's maybe like 1 foot by 1 foot, and it's got multiple compartments, and everything in my bag has a spot it goes immediately back to. And so it's really easy to forget gear. You'll be working with many forgetful musicians, and it's simply because there's just a lot going on, and it's easy to, you know, leave something on stage versus put it back in your bag. So when you're packing up for the night and when you are creating rhythms so that you don't forget things, it's really nice for your gear to have a very specific spot in your bag. And that way you won't forget about it, because it just becomes a rhythm to do this, that, and the other thing. And everything goes in its spot. And as you're leaving the venue, if you need to quickly look over all of your little compartments, you're like, yeah, that went there. We're good to go. Check, check, check. Little mental check marks all the way through. It could be even worse if you've been drinking a little bit that night, or if, you know, you're playing sober, but then you had a bunch of drinks after, and then you kind of did one last tidy up and put more stuff away. You might be kind of drunk at that point, cabin home, and it's like, you might have forgot the mic and the stand and all these things. But so have a spot for where it's supposed to go. You won't forget it that way. And the amount of gigs where even, you know, the amazing venue we're playing has all the gear, you know, where the DI for whatever reason just isn't working, or something went weird, or a microphone is just gross, right? I think it's best practice these days that most people bring their own microphones. I've got a great condenser microphone I use, and I just prefer it. I'm not so much about the germs, but more about just like the way my microphone makes me sound. So I have a preference there. But yeah, it's like you never know, even in an amazing venue with all the gear and an amazing backline, that you have to whip something out, and it's kind of on you, so you're good to go. And so for the musicians in the room, we're going to be rolling with our drum kit, depending on the gig. We're going to be rolling with our amps, our pedal boards, or cabs, all these different things that would come along with it. And so I would say, as you're going along in your musical journey and acquiring this gear, that eventually you just acquire the microphones you'll need as well. Guitar players, it's pretty standard, I think, that most will have, you know, an amp microphone with them. They're not cheap, specifically the good ones. So, you know, new guitarists might not have this right away, but, you know, all the old boys I play with do. And I think that's just like a goal you want to have as you're acquiring gear. Drummers, same thing. It's like less common for a drummer to have all their own mic stands and mics for their kit, but you never know when you need it, or you never know when you want to lend it out or rent it out or whatever. And the drummers I play with now all have mics as well. And yeah, you know, 95 times out of 100, they're sitting at home. But when, you know, when you're required to run your own sound, or when you're required to do some sort of pop-up, you know, gig or whatever, that you have it with you. Again, these things, especially if we're talking drummers, you can rent that stuff for pretty cheap, usually at most local spots. And only like the kind of hardcore nerds want to go out there and actually acquire it. But yeah, we're all nerds. We're all hardcore nerds, and we love acquiring it and having it. And, you know, the reason I bring up the details of my bag and the details of, you know, and all these funny little things and the little compartments and whatnot is because, you know, I love to really celebrate what this is. You know, I have sentimental value in all these things. This is my passion. This is what I'm excited about. You know, I get to monetize my talents and do the thing I love with all my best buds, and I made it special, right? And so I'm just saying these things because I want you to make it special. I want you to become, you know, enthusiastic about all the little, you know, secret little things you have, and all that one cable that's lasted you for like 10 years. And it's the meme, man. You're like, oh, my cables are like my children. It's like, they are, you know what I mean? When a cable breaks after 10 years, you're like, no. So yeah, it's like, have all the things that you love on you. And it's going to be hugely sentimental value to you. Music gear is being handled all the time. It's on and off stages. It's getting wet. It's getting dirty. This crap will last for you. Like, it's built to last. I'm astounded at how long most music gear lasts, and we do create sentimental value to it. So, you know, put everything in its right place. Get a special bag. You know, go the distance to make it unique for you. And these are the things that'll be wrapped up in your memories. And one day when it's all said and done, you're going to hang that stuff up, and you're just going to every time walk past it and just remember all the good times you had. So truly, like, you know, get into it, make it awesome, and really own your experience. So believe it or not, the plot thickens, because once you have all of your onstage gear, you may come to the point in your journey where you need to consider acquiring a PA and other offstage gear as well. So for about 3 years of my current musical project, we didn't kind of have the need to acquire anything around the stage until we were invited to play more corporate gigs and more wedding gigs. And then also around that time, we started to flirt with playing music in venues that weren't fundamentally like music venues. So we're talking, you know, community halls, pubs, restaurants, patios, breweries that, you know, didn't have that infrastructure, that weren't known as music venues, and we sort of bring in all of our gear and have like a pop-up show. And, you know, it was in these entrepreneurial kind of moments that we realized we needed a PA. So up here in Canada, we've got Long & McQuaid, and you can rent gear for super cheap. And we started doing that. But then I thought, you know what, screw it, we're renting gear so much. Actually, so about 50% of our gigs by about the 3 to 4 year mark became gigs where we were running our own PA. Now it's like 80% of our gigs were running our PA all the time. And I'll get more about that later. But, you know, so we were renting this gear, and we just did a rent to own situation. And, you know, over the span of about 2 years, we ended up acquiring as much offstage gear as was required without a stage. We don't own a stage just now. That's something that we're considering for the future, though, and really building out more of our sort of value proposition around the stage itself and the decor and everything that we're bringing with us. That's kind of the next evolution of our situation, but currently right now we have all the onstage gear we need, and then of course the PA and everything we would need to bring to a room to make sure that we can run a show exactly the way we need to. That goes so far as we have our own in-ear rig, and all the PA requirement required to mix our in-ears, and the front of house and all the rest of it. So it's, we have a pretty robust setup, and it all fits in the van, and we rip around like the Guardians of the Galaxy, basically creating musical moments in our community. Nothing holds us back, and we're completely self-sufficient to enter any kind of space, indoor or outdoor, and bring an outstanding performance. So it was when we were playing with the Calgary Flames. They had us, obviously, I've mentioned in previous episodes, they brought us into playing in the stands, and we had these in-game performances, and then we would play after the game in the clubhouse to, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people for these after-game performances / parties, where people would just pop off and have a blast. And we would run our own gear in that situation. So we brought our in-ear rig with us, which had the ability to, you know, save all of our EQ on the little iPad. And we had a pretty cool mix. And it was working with, you know, one of the best sound teams in the city, FM Sound, that one of their guys came in there. And during one of our post-game performances, this dude used to mix Nickelback, if that means anything to anyone. He used to mix that band. He's an outstanding sound guy. And he came in, and he basically saved an outstanding EQ on our iPad for us, for our front of house. And so, you know, when you have those mechanisms set up, and when you can save that intellectual property, and when you can have this like outstanding EQ, and you're just fully self-sufficient, and you're so confident that no matter the type of gig, right, top-notch venue in the city asks you to come in, yeah, you're sending the emails, you're learning about who's there, what's there, and that's easy. So of course you're taken care of there. They're gonna baby you, life is good. But on the other hand, big time company calls you in to play at a golf course, they don't have any sound system or anything, you're like, okay, you know, either you're including all of that in your checklist for a rental, or you just have it. So, you know, this is kind of late game stuff I'm talking about. At the highest level, you'll see these massive tour bus come in, and they're running massive amounts of light stages, all the rest of it, right? So this is kind of a smaller version to that. And it might make sense for your project to gear up that way eventually. You might be in a town or a city where there's a lot of opportunity, but not a lot of quote-unquote music venues, and so you will have to run your own gear. And so I hope any of this is inspiring you or creating awareness that you can run your own show. You know, we're not dependent on these venues. We're not dependent on the scene to sort of set us up. You can take this thing by the reins, and you can control your own destiny and really get going on it, and, you know, be that garage rock band that, you know, or whatever you are, right? Just, you know, you can be having fun with it. You can just be kind of free flowing with it, but you're like, you know, we're not afraid to introduce, you know, a system or a music to any type of unique venue or unique experience as required. And as you start to collaborate in these entrepreneurial ways with the different musical environments that may present themselves in your town or in your neighborhood, this is where the possibilities become endless, and it's super exciting. And you can create a flow for your band that wouldn't have existed otherwise. And if you're listening to this and you're like, Drew, I just don't know how to mix anything, like I don't have experience with a soundboard, you know, that's something that you might acquire over months or years that you're playing. I came in really green about those details. I didn't know how to EQ or turn on a soundboard or do anything. And we had a guitar player, one of our first guitar players in the band, was a touring guitar player for like 20 years. And yeah, he was kind of over the hill at that point, but he came in to rock out with us for a couple of years. And he knew how to do all that. So, you know, when we go into these smaller venues and we were required to run our own sound, you're right, they'd have like a PA set up and a little soundboard on the side of the room. You plug in, run your own sound. Small pubs are often like that. You know, they don't have the budget to book a sound guy, and it's required that you kind of know how to like turn it on and level up and whatever. So, you know, that was Stu. He would kind of do that for us. And, you know, over the months and a couple of years that he was with us, I got Stu. I was like, hey man, you got to show me how to run a soundboard. And it, you know, it's not difficult to use a little, you know, a little board like that. But that being said, there also might be guys in your community that can either teach you or someone that can come and saddle up beside you and run that with you for the first few, and kind of set you in motion. So that's been my experience. The old boys and the old dogs in the scene love to share information. They love to help young or inexperienced bands kind of rocking and rolling. The amount of times I've helped people is like countless. you know, so I have a bit of a flow in my local community. I've had bands call me up or I'll show up or whatever, and I'm happy to do that as well. And basically every guy in my band is essentially like that. And then I know like 100 other people that are just as eager to lend a helping hand for free or to share some knowledge, right? Hence this podcast series. So realistically, like, don't let the knowledge hinder or burden you if you're becoming a part of your community. As I've suggested in other lessons and in other episodes, like, if you're becoming part of your community and finding synergy around like-minded people, it's simply about learning where what people know and asking them if they can help you out at that next gig where you're going to run your own system. A couple other nitty-gritty details I wanted to list in this episode was certain nuances around emailing. So if you are the coordinator for your band, or if you have some influence on how your band is communicating with venues and people around any type of opportunity, what you need to keep in mind and what you should really focus on is being as exact and as timely as possible in your communication. So this is all coming from the side of me and the knowledge that I have in booking at multiple venues. And so as the guy, you know, booking bands at venues, what is super common is even long-standing musicians, like career musicians and bands, asking just, sorry, I'd have to say, it's just the dumbest questions over and over and over again. And clearly they are on autopilot, or they're anxious, or, you know, they haven't visited the venue frequently, or what, I'm not sure what it is, honestly, but I get these, you know, 10 plus career guys who have played the venue, like, just re-asking the dumbest questions, and it's super frustrating. And I don't got time to answer those questions. I'm not getting paid enough. Like, you know what I mean? I don't really hold that mentality, but if someone did, they'd be justified. So the best bands I've worked with are extremely exact in what they require to know. Like, you know, here's our stage plot. Let us know if we need to bring anything. Let us know what time we're on, sound check, play time, da da da. The venue usually has these things templated. If they've got any sense of professional flow, or they have a contract, they'll send. So it's all kind of automated. But you know, so we don't want to lead with like 100 really dumb questions for the venue. One, we're trying to be as self-sufficient as possible. Another really good rule of thumb is if you're playing a new venue, get in there a week before you play. Seriously, just walk through, go get a beer, go talk to somebody, just make a point to get out there and walk through, just lay eyes on the stage. You don't even have to ask questions. You just want to see what's happening. Go catch a show the week before, whatever, right? Like, you know, it'll answer all your questions about a backline, all these little things. Yeah, so, you know, take the matter into your own hands. Always walk through a new venue. Just see what's up. A lot of the old dogs in this industry, including myself, love phone calls. So, you know, jump on a phone call if it makes sense, especially if it's like a bigger gig and there are a lot more strings attached because it's at a festival or a massive venue, or you're opening for a big band. The booking guy might just want to get you on the call. So do it and just run all those details real quickly, check box everything, and kind of take notes and, you know, throw all that at the band in the group chat. Make sure everyone's good to go on that. There's this whole idea that's kind of been percolating through the internet recently, specifically on the internet, around relationships. And it's about, like, you know, eliminating or helping with like the mental load and or talking about like micro stresses. And though I don't always agree with all these ideas, I do like the articulation of it. And the coordinator of your group, if they're also one of the key members, right, they're the guitarist, they're the bass player, whoever they are, you know, these stress points, these micro stresses will build on them leading up to the gig, because, you know, everyone in the band as well is asking 100 kind of dumb questions, right? And so it's like, you're going to play shows where you don't have all the information. And every once in a while, the communication will be a little shoddy with a venue, or you should be familiar with what's happening there, because, you know, you've all been to the venue before to watch a jam or to watch a show. But that being said, now you're playing it and everyone's excited. And, you know, now three of the members are just needing all this information. So your group chat is blowing up and you're the guy in charge and you're getting frustrated because you're like, dude, you should know. It's like, Johnny, you should know. And then Jane is probably looking at her phone and she's eye rolling. She's like, I know, right? So it's like, and then y'all show up and Johnny should have just cooled his jets and just walked in. And so this is one of the key sort of principles that we hold in my band, is that it's better just to show up than ask questions, right? There's going to be a specific amount of information that's required, which is load in, setup, sound check, performance time. Like, those four key things are really all you need to know, as long as you have the other information about the venue, right? If we've done our due diligence to do the walkthrough beforehand, or it's got a great website, or they send a contract, or they send a templated confirmation email, those things can all be forwarded to the group members, or, you know, that information can be reiterated in the chat. But we try to eliminate as much internal unnecessary communication as possible, because it is really, it's unnecessary. And I can tell you right now, and I'm sure other people have experienced this as well, that I would argue maybe 75% of the gigs that we've ever played, so I'm talking hundreds and hundreds of gigs, that the nuances around the timing and the little minor logistics change. And it didn't matter how much we prepared, right? It didn't matter that they gave us Jane's phone number as the sound person, because it wasn't Jane. She got sick and she canceled. It was this guy named Jim. And then Jim was half an hour late because he was double booked and he was the last option they had, right? Like, these little, that's a perfect example. There's so many silly little examples, and then people are just like, oh, what's this all about? What's that all about? It's like, bro, just show up, seriously. And so, you know, I don't know who needs to hear this, listening to this, but it's kind of one of those moments. And so as a band, we're constantly telling each other to kind of shut up. It's like, listen, bro, you know the drill, just show up, let's get it. And, you know, we do that in kindness. We do that with a laugh, obviously, because we've been through it so many times. So it's about eliminating as much unnecessary communication and micro stresses as possible, and carrying that load together by defaulting to what we know we've done over and over and over again. And side note to that, though, as a new band, again, if you're listening to this and this is, you're just getting geared up and you're really stoked to get going, then put in all the due diligence. And after doing that for a season or a year, a lot of these WTFs and these insecurities will kind of work themselves out, and you'll start to find rhythms, and you'll start to feel a lot of confidence in the knowledge that you have, and you'll understand your scene, and you'll understand each venue, and life is good, right? Like, who's who in the zoo, what's going on where, and it'll be a beautiful thing. You'll start to have all this intellectual property with you everywhere you go. You know, as I conclude this episode, I realize I'm going to have to do a part two on these logistics, because there's a lot internally y'all can do together as a band in terms of how you're communicating, how you're scheduling your bookings, and how you're taking care of your finances and whatnot. These are all nuances and details that I offer in my artist mentorship program, which you can find and learn more about at www.thefrontiersteam.ca. And it's 1, 2, or 3 sessions where I get together with you, and basically you or your band, or however y'all want to break this down, and we do a full evaluation, build into your situation, the assets you need, and then further knowledge around specifics of your band. And would be super happy to discover what that looks like with you, and to do these evaluations, and to create the mentorship moment, and to create as much independence with your group as possible. So thanks again for listening, and there's going to be a whole nother batch of episodes coming out in the very near future, and I look forward to continuing this journey with you. Again, that's www.thefrontiersteam.ca if you want to move in the direction of artist mentorship. Have a great day.